Well, church, together we have been asking the question, how is it that Mary goes from a place of fear or stirred upness that we talked about last week to a disposition of joy and hope that we see in her song that's called the Magnificat at the end of Luke chapter 1, but that we also see in her embrace of the call on her life by God that the angel Gabriel gives to her. And the assumption of this sermon series is that in the message of Gabriel, we find the reasons for her to not be afraid. Again, it's important for us to remind ourselves that fear is in and of itself not evil and not sinful, and in fact, a quite natural human emotion. So the message of the angel to Mary is not, hey, don't be weak, don't be silly, don't be so afraid all the time, or you're in sin. It's more, you don't have to allow your fear to govern your existence. There's actually something more significant that brings you hope and joy. And so last week we talked about the first statement of Gabriel to Mary, that you have found favor with God. And we talked about the significance of that term favor and its relationship to Noah and to Moses and to the people of God in Israel throughout the Old Testament. And that Mary, too, was a recipient of this. And today, we find the second statement. So I want to read Luke chapter 1 again with you, starting in verse 26. In the sixth month of Elizabeth's pregnancy, God sent the angel Gabriel to Nazareth, a town in Galilee, to a virgin pledged to be married to a man named Joseph, a descendant of David. The virgin's name was Mary. The angel went to her and said, "Greetings, you who are highly favored. The Lord is with you." Mary was greatly troubled at his words and wondered what kind of greeting this might be. But the angel said to her, "Do not be afraid, Mary. You have found favor with God. You will conceive and give birth to a son, and you are to call him Jesus. He will be great and will be called the Son of the Most High. The Lord God will give him the throne of his father David, and he will reign over Jacob's descendants forever. His kingdom will never end." "How will this be?" Mary asked the angel, "since I am a virgin." And the angel answered, "The Holy Spirit will come on you, and the power of the Most High will overshadow you. So the Holy One to be born will be called the Son of God. Even Elizabeth, your relative, is going to have a child in her old age, and she, who was said to be unable to conceive, is in her sixth month. For no word from God will ever fail." "I am the Lord's servant," Mary answered. "May your word to me be fulfilled." And the angel left her. Gabriel says to Mary, "Do not be afraid." And the first reason he gives her for that is, "You have found favor with God." The second reason he gives her is the second statement. "You will bear a child and you shall give him the name Jesus." Now think about this with me for a minute. How on earth does the news, "you will bear a child," invoke joy and hope in the midst of Mary? The news of an impending birth is significant for sure, but tumultuous to say the least. Now I understand many rejoice in the news of a pregnancy and a soon-to-arrive child, and many have longed for that, and to this point have not yet had that. So I don't make light of that in any way, but we have to put ourselves not in our shoes, but in Mary's shoes. "You are going to have a child" would not have instantly brought her hope and joy. In fact, it would have doubled her down on her fear. She wasn't even yet married. In 2003, Rachel and I lived in Chicago, Illinois, fantastic place to live. and I was a full-time graduate student in seminary at Trinity, and Rach was working full-time, and she said to me one evening, "Adam, I think I might be pregnant." And my supportive husband response was, "Yeah, right, there's no way." And so she took a pregnancy test, and it said she was pregnant. And so my response was, "Better take another one." And I think we might have taken 4 or 5, 6, 30, I don't know, because I was not willing to receive this news. And in fact, she was pregnant, and it was utterly terrifying to me at the core. Now, Jackson is a wonderful gift from God, and I love him more than I've loved anything in my whole life outside of Rachel. And so that's not to speak towards him. It's to speak to my position in life. I was a full-time student. We were living in an apartment. We were hundreds of miles away from family. Rachel was supporting us fully, and this plan was all collapsing all around me with the news of pregnancy. Maybe you can relate to that experience in your life. And the truth is, sometimes the news of a pregnancy can be difficult, even if it's not your first. One of my favorite comedians, Jim Gaffigan, said this upon his wife giving birth to their fourth child. He said, "When people ask me, what's it like to have four kids, I tell them, it's like you're drowning and someone hands you a baby." I make light of it, but we get the sense here that this probably shouldn't have brought her hope and joy, and yet there's something different about Mary and something different about her culture that we need to stop and understand. Mary is a story-formed woman who lived in a story-formed culture. That is an oral tradition, a culture with the stories that made the people that she belonged to significant, that gave them identity and value. These stories were told over and over and over again and gave full life to who they were. In fact, this is what God instructed the people of Israel to do in Deuteronomy, specifically in Deuteronomy chapter 6. And so Mary could hear the echoes of the stories of God's people in the words of Gabriel to her. It's kind of like us as Americans sometimes, right? There's stories that are super famous about the America that as Americans we just kind of know them, right? We know that George Washington wasn't supposed to cut down the cherry tree, but he did it, but he couldn't lie. Of course, we found out later that that story is probably not true, but it's part of our tradition, so we keep telling it. So that if someone referenced the cherry tree and not lying, we would know instantly as Americans exactly what they were referring to. Or if someone said Honest Abe, we'd know Abraham Lincoln and those stories. Or if someone referenced Ground Zero, right? We would go instantly to 2001 and remember that context. Because even so, we too are story-formed people. Now, as a pastor, I could stop and poke all of us in the eye and say, it's a shame that we're more story-formed by our national country of origin than we are by our church and by our Christian stories of origin, but I won't do that. And so Mary, when she hears these statements, doesn't just hear them as news for her, she hears them in this story-formed culture. Now, I'd be remiss if I didn't pause and say this. I don't want to take too much time here, but it's significant in that there's a lot of praise to be given in how Mary responds to the news of the angel Gabriel. And we often look at Mary and say, man, what a remarkable woman. And we are right to do that. In fact, she was. And she loved God and she honored him. But we're remiss if we don't stop and say, man, look at the ministry of Mary's parents in her life to get her to this place. Again, if she's 12 or 13, like many scholars assume she is, they've played a significant role as the storytellers in her story-formed world. Or her community of faith, her synagogue, the town, the people who are speaking into her, that have prepared her with these stories of God's faithfulness and who He is, that when God speaks, she's ready to receive it. And also, significantly, the role of a mentor in Mary's life. We see this in the person of Elizabeth, who probably in many ways, after Mary receives this message from the angel Gabriel, she goes immediately to Elizabeth, and my guess is Elizabeth even helps her flesh this out even more about what God's saying. Again, church, we see the significance of community in the maturity of followers of God. And we don't do this on our own, but we are the products of those who have come before us, and we have a role in equipping those around us with the story of God. That's a whole sermon for another day, so I'll set that aside and feel like I've at least made the point. Mary hears the echoes of the stories of God. And so when she hears the news about a child, probably her mind is going in several places. She understands that in God's economy, oftentimes an unexpected or miraculous child is a grand testimony of the faithfulness of God to His people. She would remember the story of Abraham, whose wife Sarah was very old and couldn't have a child. And when God said, your wife will have a child, Abraham's response was to laugh, right? This could never happen. And yet God's promise to Abraham was that from him would come a great nation. And God had to do something miraculous for that to happen. And so Isaac, the son of Abraham, became a testimony of God's faithfulness to his promises. Somewhat surprisingly, or perhaps unsurprisingly, Isaac and his wife, Rebekah, have the same experience, even if not to a lesser degree. And once again, a miraculous child or twins are born in God's faithfulness. And we even see it in the prophecy of Isaiah, in Isaiah chapter 7, when King Ahaz finds conquering nations around him, and he's afraid, and God says to him, "Ask me for a sign," and he says self-righteously, "I would never put the Lord to a test," as if it was his initiative. And God says through the prophet Isaiah, "I'll give you a sign anyway, the Alma," the Hebrew word, "the young woman will be with child, and she will be called, give him the name Emmanuel, and this is a sign to you that before he's able to know the difference between wrong and right and care for himself, Israel will be free of these invaders." That is this sign of this child, this young woman giving birth to a child is a sign of God's provision and faithfulness to Israel, even in the face of attacking armies. Some semblance of this must have been going through Mary's mind. She didn't process the news in the way that you and I might have. But what's more, this child wasn't just a sign of God's faithfulness. There was something bigger. And we see that in the rest of Gabriel's proclamation about this child to Mary. I don't want to spend too much time here, because that's what we'll do in the coming weeks here, as we continue to tease this passage out of Gabriel's message to Mary. But suffice it to say, Gabriel has significant things to say about this child and what he will be and what he will do. And there's a deep sense in which God is not just calling Mary to see in this child his faithfulness, but he's actually calling her to place her faith in this child. A more recent Christmas song written by Mark Lowry asks the question repetitively, "Mary, did you know?" And one of the questions he says, "Did you know that this child that you deliver will soon deliver you?" And there's a sense in which, yes, she absolutely knew that God was calling her to place her faith even in this child. Think about this for a minute and the kindness of God. that he is not calling Mary to place her faith in some invisible thing, right? Some invisible creed or dogma passed on from generations that we just blindly trust. He's calling her to place her faith in Jesus, just like us. Not intangible, not unknowable, not far off, but intimately acquainted with our struggle and our suffering, deeply knowable and relatable, the reality of God come to be with his people. Christian faith is not a faith in an invisible creed or a concept or idea. It's the faith in Jesus, who he is and what he has done. But the echoes ring even deeper, I would imagine, for Mary than these stories of miraculous childbirth, because they were somewhat to be expected based on what God said. What happened to Mary was incredibly unexpected, right? God hadn't come to her previously and said, hey, I'm going to make a great nation out of you, and now he's got to figure out how to do that. And so a child would be the natural result of that. This was incredibly unexpected, and it was proclaimed by an angel. And so is there an instance where something like this had happened before? And the answer is yes. In Judges chapter 13, you might remember the book of Judges in the Old Testament, is the story of God's people after they have come into the promised land. It is not a pleasant story all the time, and yet God continues to deliver his people. It's a cyclical story in the book of Judges. That is that God delivers his people, and then they worship him for a little while, and they fall off and worship other gods, and they go into exile or are conquered by a foreign nation. And then God hears the cries of his people. He raises up a deliverer who rescues them once again, and the cycle continues in the book of Judges. It ultimately leads to the final judge in Judges chapter 13. An angel appears to an unnamed woman. We just know that she's the wife of Manoah. And he says to her, you are going to give birth to a son, and he will be a deliverer for Israel. In the very same way as the story of Mary, we have an incredibly common woman from the tribe of Dan, unnamed, not significant. She's not Sarah or Rebecca, these great matriarchs of the faith. She's just a regular person, just like Mary. And an angel appears to her out of nowhere, totally unexpected, just like Mary. And in both cases, the angel comes to the woman who's going to give birth long before he ever speaks to the husband. And in fact, leaves it up to this woman to break the news to her husband. But then follows up by speaking to the husband and assuring the husband that this, in fact, is of God. Of course, Mary would go on to give birth to Jesus. The wife of Manoah gave birth to a boy named Samson. And Samson was born into an Israel that was being oppressed and ruled by the Philistines. Jesus was born into a nation that was being oppressed and ruled by the Romans. And each of them were born into a tradition, a belief that God was raising up rescuers, right? The book of Judges that I just told you, the consistent, though hundreds of years sometimes in between, the consistent hearing of God, hearing of God's people by God and raising up a deliverer in the line of the judges. This was what he did. And in the days of Jesus, there was the messianic belief that come from the Maccabees and other places, that God was raising up someone who would restore and rescue and deliver Israel and lead them back into, in essence, their glory days as a nation dwelling with God. In both cases, the angel is speaking into deep national hopes by pulling out a random common person and calling her to incredible faith. Well, many of you know the story of Samson, and so I won't belabor the point, but a few things are said of Samson. The first is that the Spirit of the Lord will be on him with power. And Samson miraculously and with great might is victorious over the enemies of Israel. And a story formed Mary, having an angel appear to her as if out of nowhere, speaking of a child being born. I have to believe she went right to this story and began to believe that this child was going to be a deliverer like Samson, that the Spirit of God was going to fall on him with power. Imagine some 20 or 30 years later, at the baptism of Jesus, as Mary watched from the shores, when the voice of God spoke and the dove descended on Jesus, and he said, "This is my Son in whom I am well pleased." Imagine the fulfillment of that belief that started when the angel spoke to her. And that through miraculous victories, he would defeat the enemies of the people of God and deliver them. Mary perceived the news of a child differently than we might in her circumstances. And she most likely believed this would be a child like Samson. And the echoes continue, because the angel doesn't just leave it there about the child, but instructs her what name to give him. And she says, the angel says, give him the name Jesus. And Jesus is an odd name, if we just perceive it from our English language, but it's actually a transliteration of a Hebrew name, right? It's the name Yeshua in Hebrew. And so Jesus wasn't his name. His name was Yeshua, and it had a deeply important meaning. It meant in Hebrew, the Lord saves, reaffirming this Samson-like message. But there's something even more significant. The Hebrew name Yeshua has an English translation. It's the name Joshua. Did you know that? That Jesus' actual name is Joshua? Now we've transliterated and called it Jesus to give it reverence, to give it significance, to separate him out from anyone. But when the angel said, give him this name, he meant very significantly to align him with the Joshua of the Old Testament. And so the echoes must have been rippling in Mary's heart when this child like Samson would also have the name Joshua. Now, the Exodus story is central to the identity of the people of God. And Jesus, from his very beginnings, was placed right inside of it. The Exodus story, of course, finds Israel enslaved in Egypt. And God, through Moses, restores his people and he brings them out into the wilderness. But of course, in the wilderness, as soon as any difficulty shows up, the people of God, much like you and me, turn to grumbling and wishing we were just back in the old way and not living in gratitude for who God is and what he has done. It leads to 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, living in the midst of their gripe and their ingratitude as people. And ultimately God says, this generation is going to die off and a new generation will emerge. And Moses himself dies without entering the land, and Joshua rises up to be this new leader of this new generation of Israelites. And so in the naming of this childlike Samson as Joshua, God is saying two very profound things through his angelic messenger. The first is that a new generation is rising up. A new generation is rising up. And pulling on the prophet Isaiah to help us understand what that means, in Isaiah chapter 40, God said, I will do a new thing. Before, my law used to be written on tablets of stone. Now it will be written and inscribed on your heart. No longer will it be dependent upon your performance, but it will be fully dependent upon my character. A new generation is rising up in the way of the story of the Exodus and the journey in the wilderness. And so it should not be insignificant to us to understand that the story of Jesus' birth is told in a very nomadic fashion, isn't it? Almost as if they're journeying in the wilderness. Right? They're on their way to Bethlehem. They get there, there's nowhere for them to reside. They've got to have this nomadic sort of existence, this wandering sort of existence where they give birth in some kind of cave or a place where animals are kept, and Jesus is placed into a manger. We get this sense of unsettledness, of journeying, of not yet having arrived. It's a wilderness-like story. And the significance of the virgin birth, certainly in the fact that God is entering into the world, and it's not just human conception, but also the sense of a new womb giving birth to a new generation. There's great church historical belief that Joseph was well advanced in years and Mary was quite young. And Jesus sort of bridging the gap between the old generation and the new generation, born in the wilderness, but ultimately to be the leader of this new and emerging generation. And just like Joshua, to be the one who parts the Jordan River and finally leads his people into the promised land. In fact, we see in that very same baptism of Jesus where the Spirit descends on him in power, a practice that had been begun by John the Baptist and his contemporaries of baptizing people in the Jordan River, certainly for the sense of purification and consecration and dedication to the Lord, but it was also a practice of reliving the parting of the Jordan River and the re-entry of God's people into the land. And so Jesus, when he agrees to it, we know he doesn't need personal atonement in any way, but he is once and for all breathing that storyline into its fullness. In that same moment, the Spirit descends on him in power. He parts the Jordan River in his baptism. The new generation has emerged in Jesus, and he's leading his people into the full experience of this new promised land. The echoes are rich in the prophecy and the message of Gabriel. And they would have turned the heart of Mary away from just isolated fear and towards joy and hope in a God who is faithful, in a Son who is not only the embodiment of the faithfulness of God, but whom would also be a great rescuer of God's people, even of Mary herself, and would finally lead Israel back to the place where God would once again dwell with them in this land that he had promised them, this full experience that God had long promised and been after. It was upon her. Mary, did you know? I think she did. No, and it gave her hope and joy. And friends, how much more you and me? Because we are far more privy to how the story played out than Mary was in that moment. You see, Jesus was not just another in the line of Joshua's. He was the ultimate and final Joshua. If you read the book of Joshua in the Old Testament, you'll find that Joshua was faithful to God, largely, but not fully. That Israel went into the land and took it largely, but not completely. That Joshua had victory over much of Israel's enemies, but not all of them. And these three things would come back to constantly torment and suppress the people of God. But we know that in Jesus, we have the final and full experience of completely claiming the land of God's promise, of once and for all fully defeating the enemies who are not just foreign nations, but rather the full enemy of sin and death. Jesus is the ultimate Joshua. And Jesus is not just another Samson or another deliverer in the line of Samson. He is the ultimate and the final Samson. If you're familiar with the story of Samson, he was a mighty warrior. It's said that he took the jawbone of a donkey and killed an entire army with it. He was incredibly powerful, full of the Spirit, a great rescuer of the people. It said for 20 years he granted freedom to the people of Israel, but he was a deeply flawed human being with a lustful passion for wicked things that ultimately were his downfall. He was acquainted deeply with sinfulness. So much so that at the end of his life, he's being paraded by the enemies of Israel who had defeated him. He's being paraded in front of them and made fun of. He's asked of him to perform for them. And he finds himself in their temple, and he leans up against pillars and he prays to God, asking God just one more time to grant him his full strength so that he can defeat this enemy and die with it. Do you remember the story? He leaned his right hand up against a central pillar and his left hand up against a central pillar, and he pushed his arms out straight, and the pillars moved, and the ceiling came down, and it crushed the enemy once and for all, and crushed and killed Samson as well. In Jesus, we have not just another in the line of Samson, but the ultimate and the final Samson. One whom the Spirit has fallen upon with power. One who through miracles and might has won great victories. But unlike Samson, one who was not given to his flesh and yet willingly submitted to the rule and the authority of God. Yet, like Samson, he too became acquainted with sinfulness. But by his choice for our rescue, so that before this manger would lead to a great throne that Mary perceived in that moment, it would first take a dramatic turn towards a criminal's cross. And remember with me the stories of the cross. Jesus, seemingly defeated by Israel's enemies, captured and bound just like Samson, paraded in front of them to be made fun of. He was asked to show his power to them. And yet, he stretched out his right and his left arms on a cross. And he pushed down the great pillars of the temple of this world. And it came crushing down once and for all, killing the ultimate enemy of sin and death. And in so doing, taking his own life. Jesus is not just another Samson. He's the ultimate Samson. And so too, Jesus does not just offer a new experience of a promised land. Jesus himself is the ultimate experience of God's promised land. In the Old Testament, the promised land was spoken of as a land flowing with milk and honey. Agricultural vernacular for fullness of life. Everything you need is taken care of. It happens of its own. You have to tend to it for sure, but there it is, and God is providing it to his people, an Eden-esque kind of existence. Jesus says now through his great victory, he's not leading us to some physical terrain somewhere in the Middle East or some other place. He's leading us to a different kind of union with God, a spiritual experience of connection to Jesus. The New Testament writers call it union with Jesus. And he says, in me, John 10:10, is the full experience of life. The promised land is not a recaptured Israel one day. It's Jesus. And that's why it can be already, even if we don't fully experience it in its fullness yet. Where do you find a land flowing with milk and honey? In Jesus. It's there where you find rest for your soul. It's there where you find a relationship with Father God. It's there where you find a peace that passes all understanding. It's there where you find the depths of joy, even in the midst of unthinkable and unbearable circumstances. It's there where you find full satisfaction for your soul. The promised land was the covenant promise of God, the place where his people and he himself at God would live, as God would live together in harmony. Where does that happen? In Jesus. The things that your soul so longs for, that cause you to give into the human experience of fear and make it definitive for your life, is a life lived only in the wilderness. Jesus has defeated the ultimate enemy of sin and death. And he has fully taken this land where God dwells, and he has led us into it through the announcement of the gospel. And friends, it is only there where your soul finds its fullness and its rest. Mary, when she heard the words, "You shall have a son and you'll give him the name Yeshua," it began to transform her from fear to hope and to joy. Why? Because she understood the God who promises children in miraculous ways. And she understood the echoes that this would be a childlike Samson. And she sure as heck knew what Yeshua meant. That this child would lead his people to once again dwell in the presence of God. She might not have fully understood just how grand the victory was going to be, but she knew what the angel meant. Friends, we are not just people who celebrate Advent. We celebrate Good Friday, and we celebrate Easter. And we recognize every Sunday when we gather the empty reality of the cross. And so how much more you and me than even Mary in that moment should embrace this life and this God even in the midst of challenging circumstances. Pray with me.